She better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be running her door.
Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of water. You fry some garlic. It's and you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. And you gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. And a little bit of sugar. And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce. Potatoes,
yeah. I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
Welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Lena Jordan, thanks for tuning in. Man, what a week, what a weekend. We had the Heirloom Expo, Slow Food, Fresh Food Picnic, the Glendee Ethnic Food Festival, which just wrapped up, the Heirloom Tomato Festival, the Old Grove Festival, and farmers markets everywhere, lots of heirloom tomatoes. Hope you've been able to enjoy at least some of it. There was even the Napa Valley Aloha Festival, where I spent almost all of Saturday. Anyway, it's that time of year in Sonoma County. But, you know, tonight you can kick back, pour yourself a glass of wine, or maybe, given tonight's topic, a gin and tonic, because we're going to celebrate Julia Child, whose 100th birthday is actually being celebrated all this year. Julia died on August 13th, 2004, just 2 days short of her 92nd birthday. She was, and really, Julia Child still is, among the most famous and recognized people in all the world. She transformed American cooking. I don't know if any other cooks have been so perfectly satirized on Saturday Night Live. The thing that they did with her cutting her finger. Oh my God, it's still one of the most hilarious things I've ever seen. But she really got famous a lot earlier than that. She came on the stage really fairly late in her own life, certainly by today's standards, when really young kids are becoming famous. She was around 50. It was a time when America was falling in love with France, French cooking, and all that sort of thing, largely because we were enchanted by the Kennedy White House and its French chef, Rene Verdun, and of course by Jackie Kennedy herself, who both spoke French and charmed France as perhaps no other person, certainly not in my lifetime, had charmed them. And then here comes Julia teaching the American housewife how to take what was somewhat mysterious form of cooking, French cuisine, haute cuisine, and do it in their very own kitchen. It was really an amazing time, and a time when public broadcasting was in its infancy and was really a Julia Child who transformed it. Now there's a new biography. It is called Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child by Bob Spitz. He's the author of several books, including the remarkable Beatles biography. It's really something. His book on Julia is a comprehensive tome, over 500 pages, and it's so riveting, so thorough, and at times so vivid that you just feel like you're in the room or in the television studio right there with Julia. So tonight we're going to hear from Bob. We're also going to hear just a bit of conversation with Stephanie Hirsch, Julia's longtime assistant, who was a guest on Mouthful a few years back, and we will also hear a bit from Julia herself from an interview I recorded with her and Jacques Pepin. Well, Bob Spitz, welcome to Mouthful. It's great to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you, Michelle.
And, you know, I have to say, your book has done me a lot of good already because it's really heavy. I think my triceps are getting better.
Well, this is actually a short one for me. You know, 500 pages, I kind of cranked it out.
It's a remarkable book.
Oh, thank
you. It really is remarkable. And I was very lucky to know Julia Child, not well, mm-hmm. but our paths crossed on many occasions and in many different ways. Mm-hmm. And all of it seems to be covered in one way or another here in the book. So one of the things I'm really curious about is the subtitle, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child.
Yeah.
And on one hand, you look at it and you just say, yeah, of course. But then on the other, it's like, well, maybe ask the question, why was it so remarkable?
Oh, well, that's easy. I can tell you. she was a kind of ordinary woman who remade her life at midlife. I mean, this is a woman who at 40 couldn't cook. She didn't know how to boil water. And at 50 had never been on TV. So at 51, when she is on TV as one of the most influential food people in our lives in America here, she has remade her life inside out. I find that completely remarkable. And the fact that really Julia became a celebrity just by being herself. You know, she didn't like prepackaged food, and she wasn't prepackaged in any way either.
She wasn't going on any competitions trying to get attention, because there weren't any competitions.
There weren't. Yeah. She invented the medium. And not only that, you know, she was a seemingly ordinary person. She did not have media training to correct that savage warble of hers. She didn't have a battalion of stylists. In fact, you know, I think she wore the same blouse like for 30 years while she was on TV. But, you know, she just was ordinary. And that ordinariness, backed with her incredible intelligence when it came to cooking, transformed America. And to me, that's why I use the word remarkable, mm-hmm. because it took our culture and sent it into someplace different.
Yeah, it really did. How much of it do you think we can attribute to Julia herself? And I know it's a lot, but also no one could have invented better timing.
No. In fact, Julia always said that timing was everything. You know, it was 1961 when Mastering came out, and the Kennedys were in office, and they had a French chef
Rene
in the
Verdun,
White House.
Yes.
Exactly right. And so they were already setting the table. Airline travel had become, you know, very affordable for a change. The men had just come home from the war with stories about how great the food was in France. So all of this conspired to change the way things were. And also, what was interesting was that restaurants were changing too. At the time when Julia appeared, French restaurants were really fussy. I mean, they were all white tablecloth. There was a maitre d' at the front who was stern, who, you know, would usher you to a table, but if you misbehaved, be careful. and you were a fool because you knew nothing about French food. And this was becoming passé. So everything was changing. And Julia always said that, as I said before, her timing was perfect.
Yeah. How was it that she actually ended up in France? Would you tell that piece of the story?
Yeah. You know, it was a quirk of fate. She and Paul had come back from World War II. They were stationed in Southeast Asia. And he was a career diplomat. Julia wanted out. She was bored by working for the government. But Paul, that's what he did. And where does he get transferred? He gets transferred to Paris, of all places. And Paris was a place that Paul knew. Mm-hmm. He had been there as a young man. His mom and his sister lived there. He photographed there with Steichen. He was friends with the Hemingways there. He spoke beautiful French, and he knew about French food. So the very first day they said that they land and dock at Le Havre, Paul drives Julia to a restaurant he knew about in Rouen, and it was the oldest restaurant in France, by the way. And Julia referred to it for the rest of her life as that lunch in Rouen, because that lunch in Rouen, Dover sole, sole meunier, she put that first forkful in her mouth, and she became Julia Child with that bite. That did it. Just like in the Meryl Streep movie.
Right. And that just gives me chills. It's such a great story.
Oh, it you know, that was it. She tasted that. And this woman who had been searching for almost 40 years for something to do, something useful in her life, something meaningful, had found it with that bite of food.
And then she enrolled in cooking schools.
Yes, but first she became a milliner.
Oh, she did?
Yes.
Now, there's a part I missed.
Right. Well, you know, again, she was looking for something to do, didn't have a clue, and she enrolled in a hat-making course, and she lasted about 3 days because, she number one, she hated it. Number two, she was inept. And again, she was kind of tormented. You know, here I am, 40 years old. I'm married now. What do I do with my life? And Paul said, Julia, you know, you love that French food. Why don't you do something with food? And this little bell went off, and sure enough, there was her future. She enrolled at Le Cordon Bleu.
Now, what year was this?
This was 49.
49. There has to have been some major influences in her early life to allow her to be that open and adventurous. Did you find anything in her growing up years?
I did. You know, Julia was a really rambunctious young person. People don't realize this. She grew up a pampered person. Her dad was one of the wealthiest men in Pasadena, and she grew up with, you know, servants and butlers and a tennis court in the backyard, polo matches on the weekends. But that wasn't her world. Even though it was her world, she kind of was rejecting it. Mm-hmm. But she was a rascal. I mean, when she went to college, she majored in carousing, you know. it was prohibition, and Julia was one of the few students with a car, and she knew where every speakeasy was. And that's what she did. She drove her college friends to the speakeasy to get plastered at night. So, you know, did she have those kind of influences? No, but she had these kind of rebellious influences.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And she was also rebelling against her dad, who she loved dearly, but he was a really tough customer. He hated anything that was artistic, anything intellectual, anything French.
How had he made his money?
He was an old-fashioned businessman. And yet, you know, this was a man who went to Princeton. So, but he hated people who excelled in schools. He thought they were pretentious. And while Julia loved him, she really didn't like his whole attitude toward that. So she went the other way. And, you know, his politics were kind of way right of center. Julia started turning left, and that separated her from her dad, too. So it was all that rebellious spirit, mm-hmm. which contributed to who she became later on.
And, you know, she went to, I guess, high school up here, or relatively up here, at what was then called Katherine Branson.
Right.
Did you see her school records from
I
Branson?
I did. I had all her school records.
What kind of student was she?
You know, she was a very good student when she was at Branson. And she really enjoyed the school. She was like, she won the awards for being, you know, the best girl in the class, the most popular, but also rambunctious. You know, she would get into trouble, and she didn't care. She really didn't care. But then when she got to Smith, she was kind of a C student, not because she wasn't bright, but because she wasn't inspired.
Mm. Yeah, she wasn't interested.
Exactly right.
Now, the book opens with a very extensive prologue that examines in such detail that first cooking demonstration that she did.
Right, first time, yeah.
Yeah, when public television was in its infancy. And right. In that, I think you're quoting an associate producer or maybe the producer who was drawn to her joie de vivre infused with mischief.
Absolutely.
And I thought that was such a perfect way to characterize her.
They saw it right away. And, you know, Julia wasn't even putting that vibe out. She had never been on TV to do a demonstration like this before. And she was just determined to have fun and to do it. And this producer, a young woman, I mean, I think she was maybe 21, saw that there was something there. I mean, it was really an odd time because, as you just said, it was really at the beginning of educational TV. This is before PBS, even before NET. There was no network. Back in those days, educational TV was just this loose amalgam of stations across the country. And you really had to look for them on the dial because most of them were like, you know, Channel 62, Channel 57. And you had to tune them in. You couldn't just press a button and get there.
You had to move the rabbit ears
exactly
around.
Exactly right.
Rabbit ears.
And the cool thing was that, you know, there was no network at all. And mostly it was a group of college professors giving their lectures in local areas. Or maybe if there was a symphony orchestra, the local symphony orchestra would play one night. But with no announcers, no introductions, no anything.
No logos. You mentioned also there was a program trying to teach French to elementary school
yes,
kids.
Yes, exactly. That's the kind of
in
thing
in black
they had
and white.
Right. And that's the kind of thing they had on TV. So all of a sudden, Julia's there, and she gets her own show, and they say, you know what, maybe we should take the tape of this show and send it to another educational TV station. And they did, and then they sent it to another. And this is the beginning of a network for educational TV. Julia launched NET, and in effect, she launched PBS. She was the first syndicated star. Really remarkable. People don't understand that Julia had that much influence in our culture in that way. You know, not food, but, you know, here,
I mean,
public
television. It's transformative.
Yeah,
it's,
really,
it's
without a doubt.
It's absolutely transformative. You have so many details of her life. I feel like we could probably talk for a week. But I'm going to indulge myself a little bit here with my next question.
Okay.
Did you, for the book, interview Madeline Kamen?
You know, I didn't. I was told from the beginning that Madeline Kamen wouldn't speak with me. Mm. And Madeline Kamen did not want to speak about Julia Child.
Okay.
And I guess we should explain to your listeners.
Yeah, I want you to talk about, because it was really, it's a very long time rivalry, although I think rivalry is the wrong word because that implies it's coming from both directions. Mm-hmm. And there's something about Julia that set Madeline off.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, we should identify Madeline, who was one of the great French cooking teachers in America. And I'll also tell you that Julia really admired her as a cooking teacher. Julia thought she was a fabulous cook.
Mm-hmm.
Madeline came in from the very beginning, disliked Julia. Because Julia's show was called The French Chef. And she always said, that woman's neither French nor a chef.
Yes.
And it really angered her. She had a cooking class. She wouldn't let any of her students use Mastering the Art. She wouldn't let them mention Mastering the Art or talk about Julia. And when Julia was sick and had a mastectomy, Madeline called the station and said, well, she's not coming back. I'd like to take over her show.
Ooh, ouch.
And Julia found out about it. And she was livid. And that began a long rivalry. Julia actually did Madeline favors over the year. When Madeline wanted to start her cooking school back east, Julia sent her lists of all the great cooking teachers and schools and did that for her. But it came to no good. And it came to a point where Madeline taught in a place called Newton, Massachusetts. And so Julia would never allow Madeline's name to be mentioned in her house. It was always that woman from Newton.
Right. And I heard a few times it was also that stewardess.
That stewardess. Ah, okay.
And I guess she had worked. She met her husband.
On an airline.
I thought she was working actually on the ground.
Yes,
ticketing.
That's exactly
she wasn't
right.
Actually. She wasn't a flight attendant.
Right.
But
yeah,
close enough.
There was no love lost there, and it went on for years. Actually, to a point when I guess it was at a James Beard Memorial. Julia and Madeline were on the same dais, and there were about 500 people in the audience, and at one point, Julia got up and leaned over three people with her hand out toward Madeline, and a hush went up all the way over the audience because they thought she was going to strike her, and she was basically leaning over to shake her hand. Yeah, but everybody knew what was going on there.
Did Madeline give her her hand?
She did, begrudgingly.
Yes, but yes. I'm glad she did.
Yes.
That's a good thing. It seems like, as often happens, Julia was absolutely beloved by anyone, I think, who watched her or who met her. And
right.
She's absolutely charming and sweet and, to say, just regular when you did meet her. But there was other colleague rivalries or disapprovals or something. I found the section in your book on Richard Olney.
Uh-huh.
Really interesting. Richard Olney, of course, has written several cookbooks. And
one of the great French cooks.
Yes. So what was that all about?
Richard met Julia. He had a house, and he lived full-time in Provence, just a few miles from where Julia and Paul had their house, and where Simca lived as well. And Simca and Richard Olney knew each other well, Simca being Julia's partner, Simone Beck, her cooking partner.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard didn't like Julia. You know, Julia and Paul had Richard to dinner many times, and she cooked with Richard and Simca many times. And when Richard was promoting his book, Simple French Food, Julia invited him to the States and had him as a guest in her house. But to everyone else, Richard badmouthed Julia. He just didn't like her. That's all there was to it.
He didn't seem to like MFK Fisher either.
And he didn't like MFK Fisher either, right. So, I don't know. Someone said to me, oh, he didn't like women. I said, but he loved Simca. They loved cooking together. So it wasn't that. Mm-hmm. He didn't care for Julia Child. What can you do? He's one of the few people.
One of the very few people.
Yeah.
We'll continue our interview with Bob Spitz, author of Deary, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child, in just a minute. But first, why don't we hear from Julia herself? This is from an interview I recorded with Julia and Jacques Pepin at Kendall Jackson Winery about 3 years before her death.
Well, I think it's terrible what fear of fat has done to a lot of our industries. They have ruined the beef industry. We now have second-class beef. Only 2% of our beef is prime. And it's all because of these fear of fat people. They don't want to eat a marbled steak. And so it means that the beef has very little flavor anymore. It's really nothing. A lot of people will say, oh, really, I don't really like beef very much anyway. But no wonder, because they've ruined it.
I agree.
You say something.
Have you noticed something similar with pork?
And they've ruined pork as well.
They're ruining everything.
Has the sentiment, do you think, changed with your audiences? Are your audiences less afraid of fat these days?
Well, we hope so. I think that swinging back to a more normal and sensible diet.
Yes.
Now, you know, you couldn't eat eggs for a long while. Now they say you can eat two a day.
Yes, we're back to two eggs a day.
Thing is, don't pay any attention to those people at all.
Half of what I say is meaningless, but I say it just to reach you, Julia. 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 Ocean Child calls me. So I sing the song of love, Julia. Eyes, windy smile calls me, so I sing the song of love, Julia. Her hair of floating sky is shimmering, glimmering in the sun. Julia, Julia, morning moon, touch me, sing the song of love, Julia. When I cannot sing my heart, I can only speak my mind, sing a song of love, Julia. Calls me, so I sing a song of love for Julia.
I want to jump ahead to the end of her life and talk about that a little bit. I thought you wrote about it very tenderly.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned some things from it that I hadn't known, the decisions that she made.
Right.
And I think there's a really deep lesson for people to think about what she did. And I was very struck by, in fact, I gasped when I saw that she lost her taste for a while.
She did, yes.
I mean, to lose your sense of taste is horrible,
for
no matter
Julia
who
Child.
You are.
Right, exactly.
But
right.
Will you tell that story?
Yeah, yeah. Julia had been failing.
And this is, she's 91?
91, yes. A lot of things were going wrong. She had always had problems with her knees for years.
I mean, at 6'3", that's
she
not
was a big
surprise.
Woman, right, yeah. Who ate a lot of food.
Yeah.
She carried around a lot of weight, although she wasn't a heavy woman. But her knees had always given her problems. She had hip problems and other problems. And at a certain point, she had to take medication so that she – that took away her taste. And for Julia, that was, you know, almost the end. So a very good friend of hers, Rebecca Alsid, who started the cooking school at Boston University with Julia and Jacques Papinsel, went out to visit Julia. And Julia was sick, very sick. And she said, "Oh, Rebecca, make me an artichoke with hollandaise sauce." And Rebecca knew that, you know, Julia couldn't taste. So she made it. She made it, and she sent it up to Julia, who was bedridden. And Julia said, "Oh, dearie, you know, it needs a little more salt." And Rebecca knew that Julia was off her medication. Julia had been told by a doctor that he could give her at least another 2 years of life, good life. Excuse me, not good life, but another 2 years of life.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have meant that she would have had to take drugs where her taste wouldn't be available to her. She would have to have dialysis, which she found just a revolting thing for herself at that age, at the age of 91 plus. You know,
yeah,
she
would experience severe nausea afterwards.
She would.
Which sounds horrible.
So she told her assistant, Stephanie Hirsch, "That's it. I've had enough." She went to the doctor with Stephanie, and she said, "That's it." And the doctor said, "Julie, if you don't take this medication, you'll be dead within 24 hours. And they walked out, and they walked down the hall, the corridor, the nursing facility that Julia was living in. And she said to Stephanie, "That I'm not going to take that medication. I do not want to live that way." So when they got back to the apartment, Stephanie was crying all the way back because she knew mm-hmm. what this meant. And Julia said, "Now, dearie, I'm just going to go take a little nap." And she did. She went upstairs and laid down, and she never woke up.
She had her cat came and joined her?
Her cat came and curled up at the foot of the bed. And Stephanie put out a call to all the people who were close to Julia in Santa Barbara, where she was living at the time. She had a lot of friends there and a lot of old friends who were still around. And while what Julia called slipped off the raft. That's what she always used that euphemism for, the way she would pass on. I'm just going to slip off the raft. And that's exactly what happened. Julia went into a coma, and people came through the apartment all day long to say goodbye to her. It was a, you know, it was kind of a very, it was so Julia Child. Mm-hmm. You know, she did it her way, and she did it without any fuss whatsoever. I was very touched. And as I wrote it, and you're right, I did write it very carefully, because I thought, you know, you can't make any mistakes.
But very tender. It was very matter of fact. You're a beautifully precise writer.
Uh-huh,
I love
thank you.
Your prose.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of embellishment to get it in the way, but there was this tenderness that came through I thought was really, really wonderful.
Thank you. I had lived with this woman for 4 years. I mean, 2 years of research mm-hmm. and 2 years of writing. So, I mean, while I wrote that, I kind of wept. You
sure.
know, I mean, I was in the process of reliving this woman's death. And so I'm sure that my emotion crept into the book a little at the end.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that makes it such a compelling read.
Mm.
One thing I'm curious about,
sure.
A lot of biographers go through a period from which they sometimes never emerge, where they really dislike the subject.
Oh.
Did you ever, like, fight with Julia? You seem like you
never.
Really... Okay.
No, and
you liked her all the way through.
I did, and I'll tell you this. I'm very careful about how I choose my subjects.
Mm-hmm.
They have to have two qualities. I mean, I almost swear by this. Number one, they have to be beloved figures.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, they have to have changed the culture in some way. And I was lucky because before Julia, I was the Beatles biographer.
Right.
And while the Beatles, you know, they weren't always good guys, they weren't good to each other all the time mm-hmm. either. But I never resented them. You know, I think biographers who resent their subjects find out that in the book somewhere, they have a platform that they start to want to see through.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want that to happen. I don't want my personal views so obvious. I want to present their lives in an even-handed way. But I have to like the subject.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend named Albert Goldman who wrote a book about John Lennon that was a reviled book.
Absolutely.
It was called the... And now Albert happens to be one of the great writers of all time, but he disliked John from the start. And he alienated people from page one. Mm-hmm. In fact, there were death threats about his life. Why go through that for 4 or 5 years? Why spend your time writing about someone you loathe? I mean, I will tell you that my next book, you know, beloved and change the culture, is I'm going to be Ronald Reagan's biographer. Now, my friend said to me, how can you write about Ronald Reagan? That's not your politics. It has nothing to do with my politics.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great story, and I want to mm-hmm. tell that great story. And that's the way I felt about Julia Child.
Mm-hmm.
What a great story. So, I kind of liked her all the way through.
Yeah, and that comes through, and I love that. MFK Fisher's biographer,
mm-hmm.
she didn't like her.
Yeah.
And there was this thread of judgmentalness
mm-hmm.
throughout that really made me sad as I read it.
Well, I will tell you that my book isn't a hagiography. I wanted to put her in a cultural context, and I felt that I had to bring a critical eye to
mm-hmm.
her, which I did. I mm-hmm. don't think I was easy on Julia.
Oh, I don't think you were easy, and it's not a love story.
Right.
But
I didn't dislike her.
You didn't dislike her,
right.
And that's very obvious. And at times, you don't see your hand in that
sense. That's nice
you're
to
the,
hear.
You're the, you know, you take on that omniscient narrator that just mm-hmm. sort of fades into the background. You sort of put the reader right in some of those experiences.
Well,
I felt
yeah.
like I was in the studio in Boston with that first TV show. It
right.
was very, very concrete and visual.
Well, I did the same thing with the Beatles. The thing that I always want my reader to feel is that they're in the room experiencing it at the same time I was. So I try to do all my research and put you right there in the scene so that you see it as it's happening.
Yeah. How do you feel about Julia and how she's perceived today, especially, I mean, we've become such a foodist culture. So many people watch the Food Network and the whole Iron Chef stuff, and I know...
That's a different topic.
Yes.
I we'll get there.
We know how Julia feels about that stuff. Yeah. But do you feel that that generation of people really understand who she was and all that she has given them?
Absolutely. You know, it's really funny. When I set out to write the book, someone said to me, well, you know, your audience is going to be 50 and 60-year-old women. So many young people are buying this book. Number one, the movie Julie and Julia set the table for it. Mm-hmm. They created a great interest. But so many young men who are new chefs, new cooks, have been coming up to me at bookstores saying, I'm dying to read this. I mean, I work from mastering. I learned from mastering. Mm-hmm. I know who she is. I know what she brought to the culinary industry, and I want to find out about it. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a lot of interest among younger people.
Mm-hmm. And you think they do sort of grasp who she was?
Oh, I think they know it full. You know why? Because every good chef, and I'm talking about good ones, no matter how mm-hmm. young they are trained in a classical way. And that mm-hmm. classical way is the way that Julia taught people. You know, it's Escoffier training. And those young chefs know that Julia brought it here to the United States. And I think they're very aware of who she is.
Mm-hmm. I think so, too, and I'm glad to hear you say it. Mm-hmm. One thing I think most people, even though, you know, Mastering the Art of French Cooking and all of her books made such an impact, it's that visual Julia Child, those mm-hmm. cooking shows that I think we most imprint on. What I'm wondering is, how did she feel about writing? Did she love writing? Or did she feel like it was one of the things she had to do?
No. Julia loved to write. I mean, when she left... when she left Smith College, she said she was on her way to New York to become a great woman novelist.
Oh, okay.
And she failed miserably.
Did she ever try a novel like M.F.K. Fisher did?
She didn't, no. Mm. But she did. She tried to get a job at The New Yorker. They wouldn't have her. She took the editing test at Newsweek. She failed. She was given an assignment at the Saturday Review. It was awful. So she wrote ad copy for a furniture store. And that's as close as she came to being a writer. Mm-hmm. But when she started to write recipes and cookbooks, she fell in love with writing all over again. She really enjoyed it. And, you know, she would work. Julie would get up really early in the morning, like 5:30, 6 o'clock. Mm-hmm. She would cook all morning and most of the afternoon. And then around 10 o'clock at night, she would start to write. And she would write until 2 o'clock in the morning. She loved it. I mean, that was her quiet solitude. And she rewrote those recipes over and over and over again until she got them right, until she knew that they were scientifically foolproof. She loved that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Later on, when she hit her 80s, she had help with some of the cookbooks. She just couldn't be on the air and get the cookbooks out fast enough. What she used to do was she would be on the air, she would leave, go home, write, and get that cookbook out before the series was finished. And she just crank it out.
Yeah.
And she couldn't do it anymore. She was getting on in her years.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And Stephanie Hirsch was a great help to her as her assistant.
What would happen is that the person who was there would open the mail and put it on Julia's desk, and Julia would read the letter and dictate an answer into a tape recorder. And then the secretary would type it and then give it back to Julia to read, and she would make edits, and then the secretary would retype it, and then Julia would reread it and sign it and send it. So things were sort of going around and around and around and not going very quickly. And because of my culinary background and my, I think probably my theater background, I was a pretty quick study of her style of speaking and writing. And so I was able to read the letter, write an answer in her voice, so to speak, mm-hmm. give her the letter and the answer at one time. And then she could read both and sign it and send it. And for every, I don't know, 100 letters that I gave her, maybe one or two would come back, but mostly they were answered in a way that she would have answered them, so they were fine for her to sign and send. Mm-hmm. So it sped up the whole office process.
And Julia also had several co-writers who stayed in the background and helped her out. Uh-huh. And her editor, Judith Jones, also helped, too.
Right. Yeah. And I know that Stephanie answered a lot of her correspondence.
She did.
And she did a beautiful job with Julia's style of syntax. She just seemed to really grasp it very intuitively.
She did. And also Julia answered a lot of her own, too. Yeah. Julia was a great correspondent. When I dipped into her archives, there were 126 boxes of her writing, and it took me 2 months just to go through the first box. That's how dense it was. Julia wrote all the time, and Paul, her husband, was even a better writer. He wrote some of the most gorgeous prose I've ever read. His letters are just, they're works of art, and they're voluminous, thousands and thousands of pages.
Yeah, now she lost Paul really pretty early. I mean, a good 10 years, 15 years after a stroke, he seemed to decline.
Yeah, 1974, 78, around that area, Paul had a stroke, and he had suffered many small strokes, they found out later, and began to have an onset of dementia. When I met Julia in 1992, I was in Sicily with her. Paul was still alive. He was in a nursing facility, but he didn't know who she was anymore. And she would call him every day, but he didn't recognize her voice. I will tell you this, and it's a little secret, but she would call Paul, and then she would make another call because Julia had a lover as well. Once Paul was incapacitated. Not incapacitated, but once Paul didn't know who she was anymore. And I talked to Julia about this straight out. She said, that's not my Paul anymore.
Yeah.
Paul and I had the greatest marriage that you could ever expect. But that man's not here anymore, and life goes on. And so Julia was determined to be happy and feel fulfilled. And Julia was also a romantic, and she loved romance. And this man brought that back into her life.
Do we know anything about him?
We do. His name was John, and Paul and Julia knew him and his wife socially. His wife had died. And when Paul was incapacitated and suffering, John got in touch with her and invited her to dinner one night. And he was this big kind of strapping guy. Julia loved men,
yes.
Mostly young men. Julia loved young men.
She used to make Jacques Pepin blush.
Oh, I'll tell you another story in a moment about that. But she loved young men. But John was one of those strapping guys. He had been a baseball player. He had played for an affiliate of the Boston Red Sox. And, you know, she wanted to have a man on her arm and vice versa. So, but a really funny story about Julia and men. When she was 91 and not feeling well, she loved going to the movies. And her niece, Phyla, took her to see Brad Pitt in Troy. And, you know, Julia's voice in the theater cut right through the audience. Julia would just talk out loud. And at one point when, the battle scenes had ended, Julia, in her typical voice, loud voice, said to her niece, "That Brad Pitt, he's such a handsome guy, isn't he? I wonder what's underneath that tunic." At the age of 91.
Good.
Go get him, Julia.
That's
hey,
great.
There's hope for all of us.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah.
What were you and Julia doing in Sicily?
Ah, there's a story for you.
I bet.
I was in Sicily in 92. I was writing a number of magazine articles for American magazines. And a friend from the Italian Trade Commission called us and said, "We know you have a little extra time over there. Would you mind being an escort for an older woman?" And I said, "Excuse me, I don't do that kind of work." And she said, "Oh, too bad. It's Julia Child." And I said, "I'll be right over."
Yes.
Julia was traveling around Italy. She wanted to taste Sicilian food. Her knees were failing. She was 82. And she wanted a young arm to hold on to.
So
and
literally.
I was that young arm. Okay. I was a young guy at the time, and she loved young men. So for a month, we did nothing but go to restaurants in Sicily and eat and talk.
Oh, what a wonderful month.
About her life, about her approach to food, about everything. And I was smart enough to run a tape recorder.
Wow. And was that the genesis of the book, do you think?
Yeah, in a way it was. When we got back, I said to Julia, you know, I'd like to write a biography about you. And she was already engaged with someone at the time, writing a biography. About 3 months later, I got a call from her. And she said, oh, dearie, I wish you'd reconsider. I'm not having a good time. This book makes me seem as if I'm already dead. By that time, I was already involved with the Beatles. And it was a book that I thought would take 2 years. It took 10 years almost. And by that time, Julia had died. So I always knew that after that book, I would write a biography of Julia Child. Uh-huh. And I hope I've set the record straight.
You have. You've done a wonderful job. But I want to stay in Sicily for a couple more minutes.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about some of the more memorable things you
made? Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, here's a little secret. Julia did not like Italian food. She was bored by it. She couldn't get over the fact that she felt that the Italians had one sauce. It was tomatoes, garlic, olive oil, and onions. And it befuddled her. She would say, oh, this is so boring. It's the same sauce. You know, she cooked those great Escoffier French sauces. Mm-hmm. And to her, they were works of art. And there were hundreds of them. So she wasn't really happy with that. The other thing that we did was when we were in when we'd go into a restaurant, Julia had the habit in the States, since every restaurant knew who she was, she would march right into the kitchen without announcing anything. And, you know, she was Julia Child. And she would go right to the stove and she'd dip her fingers into the sauce and lick them and everything. Well, she tried the same thing in Italy. But they had no idea who this big woman was coming into their kitchen. And
this is in Sicily.
In Sicily.
Oh,
and
my.
These Italian chefs were not pleased. We got a lot of murderous stares. And then, you know, Julie would say, oh, look, he's not so happy, is he? Too bad. These guys, they're just silly men. They don't know what they're doing. She was great. We had a blast there talking.
When did you see her last?
You know, I spoke to her often on the phone, but I guess the last time I saw her was when we got back from Italy. She came to New York, where I live, to do a book tour. And she said, you know, we ate in so many good restaurants. I want to take you to one of my favorites. So she did, and we both had Big Macs and extra large fries. That's what she
so
did.
So that was true that she liked McDonald's.
She loved the French fries.
Fries, right. Yeah,
and
she
you
talked
know,
about them.
Every Saturday when she was older and she lived in Santa Barbara, she'd go to the farmer's market. That was her tradition. But after that, she always went to Costco for hot dogs. Julia liked
right,
hot
yes,
dogs.
Yes, I'm with her on that one.
And when she traveled, the first thing she did in an airport was she found a couple of hot dogs. She'd grab them. She'd take them on the plane with her.
That's great.
She's a great woman.
Yeah, she was. And the book, even if you've met Julia, even if you know her a little bit, or maybe even more than a little bit, when you read the book, she just becomes more and more endearing as you read, I think.
Oh, great.
And we're just about out of time. The title, did you choose it or did your publisher?
I chose it. I knew the minute I started writing that I was going to call this book Dearie. When we were in Italy, I thought Julia was going to call. She called me Dearie. I thought, oh, this is so intimate. But Julia called everybody Dearie, including the local beggars and the feral town dog. So I love the way she called people Dearie, and I thought that was a great title for it.
I think it is, too, and it's really remarkable that you were able to come and talk to us about it. The book is Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child by Bob Spitz. I highly recommend it. Hope you have a great time on your book tour.
Thank you, Michelle. I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed being here with you today.
Well, thank you very much.
Take your rest. You've been driving my blues away. Now it is my turn. Come climb beneath my wings. Sweet child, it may not be for long. Well, I may be a drinking hard like a fish that swims.
So much for tuning in to another yummy episode of Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Bob Spitz as much as I did. And I really do recommend this book. I think it's a perfect fall or winter read, curled up by the fire, that sort of thing. You'll really enjoy it. So be sure to meet me back here next week for another tasty episode of Mouthful here on KRCB.
Mouthful is hosted and produced by Michelle Anna Jordan. You can get more information on Mouthful emailing Michelle at catsmilk at sonic.net. That's C-A-T-S-M-I-L-K at sonic.net. Podcasts of Mouthful are available at krcb.org as well as at iTunes. Mouthful's engineered by Mike Young, Mary Moore Campagna, and tonight's show had additional engineering by Mark Fuller.
He told us, I have one more thing to say, children, before you think of leaving. You better think about the judgment day. Now, everyone got nervous because everyone was hungry too. Everyone was wondering what was the next thing he would do. And the preacher, he kept preaching. He said, now I remind you, if I may, you all better pay attention, or I might decide to preach all day. Now, everyone was getting so hungry. The old one started feeling ill, and one started passing out, and the young ones, they could not sit still, and the preacher's voice rose. I snuck up to the balcony, and I crept into the choir, and I begged them, brothers, sisters, help me please. I said, when I give you a signal, I said, when I raise up my hands, won't you please join with me together? Praise the Lord, I have a plan. And the preacher, he kept preaching. Long is the struggle, hard to fight. And I prayed, Father, please forgive me. And then I stood up, and with all my might, I sang to the Lord, let praises be. It's time for dinner, now let's go. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher said. Now it's the Lord, let praises be. It's time for dinner, now let's go. Yes, and I did give a signal. Yes, and I raised up my hands, and then joined with me the choir. Every woman, a child, and man sang to the Lord, let praises be. It's time for dinner, now let's go. Stop preaching, and a hush the church did fill. And then a great white dove from up above landed on the windowsill. And the dove flew down beside him. A fork appeared right in his hand. Everybody watching, the preacher ate that bird right there. And then everyone got really nervous. Preacher, he did start to glow, and as we watched on in disbelief, these were the words he spoke.
And the mama's in the kitchen, she's been there all day. I know she's cooking something good, so let's bow our heads and pray.
Sing to the Lord, let praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go. This story, children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough, even he'll get hungry too. And he'll sing to the Lord, let praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go. We got